When you are being fully who you are, you will find yourself loving everyone just as much. You will not love one person more than you love another. You will simply show your love in different ways. This is how parents are, hopefully, if they have more than one child. They do not love one child more than the other.
They love all of their children equally. This is how grandparents are with their grandchildren. This is how God is with everyone. This is called unconditional love. Actually, love by definition is unconditional. Anything less is not love, but merely individuated self-interest. Love is unified self-interest. It is the experience of the self when it sees everyone else as part of it. It is when you see everyone else as part of you. It is unity expressed.
How can I pretend that there is no difference between me and another person when there is?
No one is saying that there is no difference between you and another person. What's being said is that there is no separation. Your little finger is different from your thumb, yet there is no separation. They are all part of the same thing, which you call your hand, and it is part of the larger thing that you call your body. In exactly the same way, humans are all parts, all members, of my body. To experience being God once again, all that you have to do is remember who you are. That is, become members once again of the body of God. Therefore, choosing not to love all people is choosing not to love a part of you.
This is all very interesting on a philosophical level, but what does this have to do with my girlfriend and me?
Love all people as much as you love your girlfriend, and watch your life change. Demonstrate your human love in a different way, but love every person in the same amount, and you will change the world. This is what Jesus did. This is what the Buddha did. This is what Muhammad did.
Yes, well, I am not a god.
Actually, you are. That is what I have been telling you. Yet even those whom you would call ordinary people did this. It is what Mother Teresa did. It is what Gandhi did. It is what Martin Luther King did.
I am not a saint, either.
You are what you say you are. If you say you are not a saint, then you are not, by your definition. By my definition, you are, because I made nothing but saints.
So does this mean that I can say I love you to my girlfriend right now?
Remember the three core concepts of holistic living that were just mentioned. 1, awareness. 2, honesty. 3, responsibility. If you walk in awareness, you will be very aware of not only what you mean when you say I love you, but of the current meaning that most members of the human race place on this phrase. If you do not mean what you know they mean by these words, look to see if it makes sense to say them. Remember this. When you say something, most people think that you mean what they mean when they say the same thing. It is rarely true that you do mean the same thing, but most people think that you do. It is important to be aware of this. Many people already know this. They let other people think what they want to think about what is being said, even when they know that the other person is not thinking what they are thinking. This is called manipulation. When you deliberately allow another person to think something that you are not thinking when you say a thing, it is a form of lying. Many humans feel that it is the worst kind of lying because you are not actually saying untrue words. You are simply allowing someone else to draw untrue conclusions. If you walk in honesty, you cannot do this. You cannot say something that you know someone else is likely to misinterpret. Therefore, if you can honestly say I love you to your girlfriend and mean what you know she thinks you mean when you say it, then by all means say it. If you cannot, then do not.
How can I know what someone else is thinking?
You might try asking them. You might also try saying I love you and tell her honestly what that means to you. Clarify the differences between both of your interpretations, if there are any.
The Bible says to love your enemies. How can a regular person do this? I mean, I guess I understand how saints can do it, but how can a regular person like me do it?
The first step in moving to a place of love for everyone, including your enemies, is to move to a place of love for yourself. You cannot give to another what you cannot give to yourself. If you do not love yourself unconditionally, you cannot love another unconditionally. Remember this always. You cannot give to anyone what you do not have to give. Therefore, love, love, love yourself. See yourself as perfect, just the way you are. This is how God sees you. To have God love you, you do not have to lose weight, change your lifestyle, improve your habits, get better grades, or do or change anything at all. Believe it or not, you are completely lovable just the way you are. Remember this always. You are completely lovable just the way you are. Knowing this will change your life. Believing it will change everyone else's. That's because what you believe, you become. And when you become perfectly self-loving, you bring yourself, at last, the equipment with which you can love all others, and that can change the world.
Who wants to change the world? I'm just trying to get through the week here.
It is possible to do both at once.
How can I love myself when I see so many parts of myself that I don't like?
Consider the possibility that all the things that you don't like are actually the best parts of you.
My faults are the best parts of me?
Yes. They are your best character traits, but with the volume turned up perhaps just a notch too high.
I don't understand.
The part of you that others call spontaneous is the same part of you they call irresponsible when the volume is turned way up. The part of you that others call courageous is the same part of you they call foolhardy when the volume is turned way up. The part of you that others call confident is the same part of you they call egocentric when the volume is turned way up. All of your so-called worst faults are nothing more than your highest attributes, simply turned up too high for the music to be enjoyable. The things that people fall in love with you for are the very same things they might criticize you for if they feel they are getting too much of it. They will love you for your willingness to make decisions quickly, and yet if you do it too often in too big a way, they will call you bossy. They will love you for your incredible problem-solving ability, and yet if you use it too often in too big a way, they will say you always want to do things your way. They will love you for your keen sense of humor, and yet if you display it too often in too big a way, they will accuse you of being flighty and never serious. It is the same part of you that others are loving or criticizing, depending upon where the volume is set.
I never thought of it that way.
The exciting part about this insight is that it means you don't have to change a thing in order to be lovable. You don't have to deny a part of yourself, or condemn a part of yourself, or throw away a part of yourself. You don't have to make wrong any aspect of who you are, or try to fix yourself by making it go away. All you have to do is watch life a little more closely to see which parts of you are appropriate to have show up at any given time, and how big you should let that part of you be just then. What volume should you set? Do you understand?
Completely. Yes, I get it.
Good. It is a great thing to remember.
The very things people have made you wrong for are the things that they admire in you when they experience them at another time, or at a different energy level. What knowing this means is that you can love your whole self again, just as you did when you were a child. This is a great release. It is a wonderful moment of self-renewal and self-recovery. It allows you to give you back to yourself.
Wow. That may be, right there, the reason I'm listening to this. I mean, so I could get that.
It may be, indeed. Now, here is the trick. The trick is to walk in awareness. Look to see what each moment offers in terms of a chance to give the gift of who you are. See what part of your gift and how much of it would enliven the moment, or make it somehow better, and see if there are aspects that could be turned down. And be aware that there are times when the best gift you can give is the space to allow others to give theirs. This means learning how to let someone else show up in their best way, even though you may think you can do it better. Remember this always. Sometimes the greatest gift you can give is silence.
Thank you. Thank you for all of that. This is turning out to be a great conversation.
You're welcome. I'm glad we're having it.
Why does it always hurt so much to love someone? I'm tired of being hurt by something that was supposed to feel so good.
It doesn't have to hurt to love someone, but if one confuses love with need, it almost always will. Many human beings think that love is a response to need fulfillment. In other words, if you meet my needs, I love you. I can understand where humans got this idea since they have been told that this is how God works. You meet God's needs, and God loves you. If you don't, then God does not. This is not how it is with me, but it is how you've been taught that it is. Those teachings are hard to shake and impossible to ignore. So, let's start with them. God does not need anything from you. I do not need you to worship me. I do not need you to obey me, and I do not need you to come to me in a certain way in order to achieve your own salvation.
Well, that blows the lid off practically every religion on the planet.
Sorry, that's just how it is. God is the all in all, the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, the unmoved mover, the prime source, and all that is. There is nothing that there is that I am not, and what I am not does not exist. Therefore, by definition, I need nothing. Remember this always. God needs nothing. It follows with impeccable logic that if there is nothing I need, there is nothing I am going to punish you for if you don't give it to me. That includes your personal allegiance, the particular way that you worship or come to me, or for that matter, even admitting that I exist. I do not need you to recognize that I exist, or to pray to me, or to have anything to do with me at all. And I will not punish you in the everlasting fires of hell if you do not. I've already explained all this earlier, but I'm restating it here in case you didn't quite catch the implications of my earlier comments, or couldn't believe them. Believe them.
What does all this have to do with love?
Everything. Human beings love the way they love because they think that this is the way that God loves. Human beings think that love is a godly response to having needs met, and it is not. Love is not a response. It is a decision. A man named Scott Peck put that statement in a book called The Road Less Traveled a few years ago, and it was I who inspired him to do it. I am glad that I did, because it is an enormous truth that most people do not understand. Most people think that love is a response, and they gathered this from their misunderstanding of how and why I love you. I do not love you for what you do for me. I love you because you are, simply because you are. Can you understand that? Can you grasp it? My love is a decision, not a reaction.
I think so, yes. But does that mean we can't do anything to earn your love?
You do not need to earn what you already have. Does a rose need to earn the rain? Does ice cream need to earn your love? Ice cream does nothing to earn your love. It just is. Ice cream is what it is. And you love it. Think of things this way. You are God's dessert.
That's cute. I like that.
Thanks. Now, you know that I love you because you simply are and require you to do nothing to earn my love. I need nothing from you. Let this be your new model of love. Love gives of itself for no reason. It is not a repayment, nor can it be a bribe for what you hope will come. True love is the result of a decision you make about how you are going to be with another person. If it is merely a response to what another person does, it is not love for another at all, but a counterfeit emotion. When you make a decision to love another person before you have any idea what they might or could or will do for you or with you, that is a very high decision. You automatically increase your vibe. I mean that your being actually begins to vibrate at a higher frequency, at a faster speed. The feeling of love emanates from you like rays of sunshine. People feel wonderful around you, and so they find themselves feeling wonderful about you. Suddenly, they increase their vibes, and then you could find yourself in harmony or in sync. That's when the heart begins to flutter and the sparks begin to fly.
But how can I make a decision to love someone before I know anything about them?
Do you love people because of who they are or because of who you are?
Wow. That's a great question.
Indeed. And your answer?
I've always loved them because of who they are, I guess.
Thanks for being so honest. Now just change your reason for loving them. When you love people because of who you are,
you demonstrate that you need nothing from them, that your love is not based on what you can get from them.
But I do need something from the people I love. I can't say that I don't, because I do.
No, you don't. You just think that you do. There is not a single thing that you need from any other person in order for you to be perfectly happy. Indeed, you have been perfectly happy in many moments of your life without ever having even met half of the people that you now know.
Yes, but once I got to know them, I couldn't live without them. Especially certain ones. Especially that particular one.
This is not true. But if you think that it is true, it will seem true enough for you. It will also lead to your unhappiness. Because first you will convince yourself that you cannot be happy without a particular person. Then you will decide that it is not enough just to have that person in your life. You must have that person be in your life in a certain way. They have to be your regular girl or boyfriend. They have to be hooked up with you. After that, you will decide that in order to be happy, you must have that person in a certain way a certain amount of the time, like every free moment they have. Soon, you will imagine that in order to be happy, you must have that person in your life in that way all the time. You might even catch yourself saying that you would just die without that person. Of course, you would not mean that. What you would mean is that it feels as though a big part of you would die if that person was not in your life. Now, here comes the fascinating thing about all this. In order not to have a big part of you die from being without that person, you will kill a big part of that person. You will kill their spirit. You will so smother them with your love and with your need for their love that they will choke, they will cough, and then they will have to throw you off in order to survive. They will run away from you, which is sad, because they really liked you a lot and probably could have loved you, but they simply could not fill your needs.
It sounds like you've been following me around.
I have, but that's not why I know this. I know this because this is the way love is being experienced by most of the human race. And that is because you have confused love with need. Now here's the good news. Remember this always. You need nothing outside of yourself in order to be happy. I know that you think that you do, but you do not. This is an illusion. It is the first of the 10 illusions of humans. The illusion is that need exists. The illusion is that someone or something outside of yourself is needed for you to be happy. Yet if you still think that it is, try this exercise. 1. Make a list of the people, places, and things that you think you need to be happy. 2. Now think of a time when you did not have these and were still perfectly happy. 3. Now ask yourself, why do I think I need this person, place, or thing to be happy now? If you are honest with yourself, you will know that you do not. You may prefer to create your happiness with this particular tool, but it is not necessary to do so. Do not, therefore, turn a preference into a need.
Every time I get a girlfriend, she gets me off course. I mean, there are certain things that I want to do in life, but when I get hooked up with a girl, I always seem to go in her direction, or in some new direction she wants us to take together, but I abandon my own journey. What's all that about?
It's about fear, my friend. It's about fear. You are afraid that your girlfriend of the moment will not stay in your life if you do as you had intended on doing with your career or some other aspect of your life, and so you have given up your life in order to have the life that you think you want. The difficulty with this is that after a while you become very clear that you are not living the life that you wanted, and you become surly, irritable, and moody. You can't say that anything in particular is wrong, but nothing feels quite right. Soon, this feeling permeates your relationship, and with luck, that relationship is over. If you are not lucky, the relationship will continue for a long time, and you will live a life of quiet desperation.
How can that cycle be broken?
Here are two important questions to ask in life. 1. Where am I going? 2. Who's going with me? Most people ask themselves these questions at one time or another, but many of them make the mistake of putting the questions in reverse order. They ask the second question first. Or they may have them in good order when they first meet another, but then they change the questions around so they can get a better answer. If you do either of these things, you may have great difficulty in relationships.
My mom and I have been trying to get a family going, to find a partner for my mom and a dad for me. But so far it hasn't worked out. Why?
Maybe it is not to be.
What's that mean?
It means maybe there is perfection in things being just the way they are right now. All you have to do is see the perfection. That's all anyone has to do in any of the moments of their life in order to move from unhappy to happy. Just see the perfection. Whatever is happening, whatever is going on, see the perfection. Whatever is not happening that you wish would happen, see the perfection. Then move into gratitude for it. Say an inner word of thanks.
How do I do that? How do I say thanks for a life that is not the way I want it?
By knowing that it is the way you want it at some level. By understanding that there is always a reason at the soul level why your life is the way it is, why things have happened the way they have happened, and why everything that is showing up is showing up.
What's the reason?
You are a spiritual being, and you came to the body to experience who you are. In order to do this, you are in every moment drawing to you the exact and perfect people, places, and events to experience precisely what you came to your physical body to experience. You are in the process of recreating yourself anew in every single moment of now.
You've said this already.
I'm repeating it for emphasis. This is why you came here. This is what you are up to. Everything else is an illusion. This process is called evolution. It is the evolution of the soul. Now, if you know this, everything changes. You no longer see things as you used to see them. You no longer experience tragedies as tragedies, but as opportunities. They are your chances to announce and to create, to be and to express, to become and to fulfill who you really are. The whole world has been created as a stage on which you may do that. Actually, the entire universe is that stage, and your Earth is the part of it on which you stand.
When are you going to send me someone who will love me and see me for everything that I am? My quirks, flaws, etc., the way I look at everyone and appreciate them.
I have sent you someone. Me.
Well, you know, God, I appreciate that, but what I would also appreciate is another human being in my life to share my days and nights with me.
I know that. I understand that. Now I am going to tell you how to find that.
Great.
Simply be what you are looking for.
Be what I'm looking for?
Yes. Instead of searching for someone to love, be someone who could be loved. Send what you wish to receive. Be what you wish to experience. This is the greatest secret in all of life. Be what you are looking for, and what you are looking for will find you. Everyone is looking for the same thing. Do not therefore be the searcher. Rather be that for which others are searching.
Chapter 13. Drugs.
What is everyone so scared about my experimenting a little with drugs?
As we get started on this topic, let's get clear on our definitions. Drugs are drugs. It does not matter whether they are legal or illegal. There are what some people call medicinal drugs and what some call recreational drugs. Abuse of either can create major problems. So can abuse of alcohol, which is a drug of a different sort. Now, the answer to your question is that experimenting a little with drugs is almost impossible for human beings. Drugs are powerful, and they can take over your life before you even know what is happening. And that's the problem. Most people swear, absolutely swear, that they can handle them. They get upset when other people say, "Watch out, be careful, don't go near the stuff," because they think that they are bigger than that, larger than that, more able than other people to deal with that. Many drivers feel the same way. A strange recklessness overtakes them when they get behind the wheel. They're better at negotiating the curves than the guy who went before them and didn't make it. Put the pedal to the floor. That's all they think about. Nothing's going to happen to me. This point of view is also prevalent among many drinkers. The feeling is that you can handle it, even though statistics show that the huge majority of others crash when taking this road. Statistics don't matter. Facts become irrelevant. The thrill of the experience is all that counts. Add reckless driving to drugs or alcohol, and you've got a lethal problem.
But friends that I know are using drugs, and they think they are handling them pretty well, without any problems.
The situation with drugs is that they distort your thinking. You think that you are controlling yourself, but they control you. From the very first use, it's insidious. Let me tell you the story of the lobster and the water. One day, a lobster was put in a cooking pot by a restaurant chef, and it never even tried to climb out. Do you know why? Because the water was cool. The lobster would have been clawing and clawing to get out if the water had been hot, but it was not. Only after he got the lobster into the pot did the chef turn up the heat. And even then, he put the water over a very low flame. It took a long time for the water to boil. By the time the water got hot enough to cook the lobster did not even know what happened. If you had asked the lobster in the first few minutes, "Why aren't you trying to climb out of there? Don't you see the trouble you're in?" The lobster would have replied, "Don't be silly. I'm just swimming around in the water here."
So you think that my friends are in more trouble than they know?
Let's just say that they're in hot water. I will say it again. Drugs start to control you from the very first use. You don't think so, but they do. The fact that you don't think so is how they do. Drugs stop you from thinking the way you usually think. Take enough of them, and they stop you from thinking at all. "Oh, I'll know when to stop," are the famous last words of thousands of people who have had their lives ruined by drugs. The same can be said about alcohol.
Maybe using this stuff is dangerous.
There is no maybe about it.
But the people I know who do it are only trying to get high.
What's funny is that people do drugs or drink alcohol to experience getting high, and they usually wind up very low. In fact, about as low as you can go. And what's sad is they can get high without doing any of these things.
Yeah, I know. Get high on life.
Yay!
That just seems so, I don't know, sappy.
Most of the world has made what is sensational sappy, and what is sappy sensational. In this, most of the world has it backwards. If it is a special sensation that you are looking for, there is nothing more sensational than life. Life as it really is, not life as it is experienced through the cloudy mist of a drugged mind and a dragged out body and a desperate heart and a dampened soul. I am talking here about life as it is experienced through an enlightened mind and an energized body and an earnest heart and an elevated soul. I am talking here about pure happiness, real happiness. Not counterfeit happiness produced by artificial stimulants. I am talking about being, doing, and having at a very high level. Being, doing, and having are the three levels of human experience. All experience springs from being. Whatever you are being will determine what you are doing, and what you are doing will determine what you are having. You may not have thought about it that way, but that is the way it is. Living happily is about being something, doing something, and having something that makes your soul dance and your heart sing and your mind blow.
How can I experience that? Are you saying that I can experience that?
That's what this whole program is saying. Throughout this conversation, you have been given hints and clues and tools that you can use to be, do, and have what you choose. Drugs will not give you that. Drugs are not among the tools. Drugs destroy the tools.
Chapter 14. School.
Speaking of tools, why are we taught facts and not ideas in school?
Because ideas are dangerous if one wants to keep things the way they are, and your society does. Most societies are deeply invested in seeing things stay the way they are, because the way they are is what makes the society a society. A society is nothing more than a group of people formed around a particular way of seeing things. These people share traditions, mutually created institutions, activities, and interests. Anything that threatens those traditions, institutions, and interests must be opposed, and it certainly can't be taught. And nothing is more threatening to all of this, of course, than new ideas. Children are, therefore, encouraged to learn, but not to think too much. Thinking involves the consideration of ideas. Learning involves simple memorization.
That's exactly what it involves. Memorize the presidents, memorize the capitals, memorize the battles. Here are the facts, memorize them. This is how it is. Now just get that.
What makes this all the more challenging is that the facts are rarely really facts. That is, unvarnished statements of what is so, of what occurred. Too often they are particular interpretations of what is so and what occurred, designed to justify and solidify a particular point of view. It is this point of view that your elders seek to teach you, not simply bare facts. Thus it is that children of the human race can have entirely different understandings of what happened, and why when Japan placed its soldiers in Korea, or when the United States placed its soldiers in Vietnam, or when Israel placed its soldiers in the occupied territory of Palestine, depending upon whose children are listening to whose parents and reading whose accounts of history. In this way, the sins of the fathers are visited upon the sons, even unto the seventh generation.
Great. So I'm locked into a school system that teaches me how to make the same mistakes that my parents made. Terrific!
It doesn't have to be that way. You don't have to repeat those mistakes. Look around you and see which parts of how the world is you don't agree with. Then investigate the causes of things being that way, and decide to do something about them that could change things. It could be said that there are essentially two kinds of people on your planet, the repeaters and the changers. The repeaters are those who look at the past and repeat what was done then. The changers are those who look at the past and change what is being done so as not to repeat it. You can become one of the changers.
And one of the first things we can change is how schools work.
That is one of the first things you would have to change if you wanted to change anything at all. For what you learn, you become. And it is very hard to unbecome that.
How can we change schools?
There may not be much you can do to change your school this year or next, or maybe not even in the near future, but you can change your experience of school. Look at it a new way. See it, however imperfect, for what it is, a stepping stone that life has put in place for you to get exactly where you choose to go. Then use your new, more positive attitude to suggest some changes that you think could make the school better. Even in the least democratic schools, there should be some mechanisms in place for doing this. Have fun with it. Be a little daring. But try not to be overly critical or take yourself too seriously, or you will defeat yourself before you begin. Pass on to your parents, to those in control at your school system, and as you grow older, to anyone in your community who will listen, the best suggestions you have for changing your schools.
Got any ideas?
You could try telling them not to emphasize facts in your schools, but rather concepts. You could invite them to focus on the three core concepts of holistic living: awareness, honesty, responsibility. You could suggest they build their entire curriculum around these concepts. Do not abandon reading, writing, and arithmetic, nor any of the other academics, but rather use them as tools with which to illustrate and live these concepts. You could encourage them to create a program that includes many areas of human experience to explore, such as self-discovery and self-expression, sharing power, fairness economics, sustainable living, honoring diversity, utilizing differences, celebrating sexuality, creative thought, and the unity of all life. Tell them that if they teach these subjects, they won't have any problem keeping students in school or holding their attention while they are there. And while you are at it, tell them to try getting rid of grade levels that separate people by age, allowing students to fluidly group themselves by interests and passions. And abolish tests and scores and marks and measures, letting the joy in each child be the measure, and the sparkle in each eye and the excitement in each walk be the test of whether brains are being stimulated or numbed. And lastly, why not suggest giving students a say in how their school is run, including them among the decision makers in some real way, not in a showcase way?
Wow, what a school that would be. And one of the first things I would change is homework. Why do we have to have 3 hours of homework after 7 hours of school?
That's a question that even adults are looking at now. A recent study by the University of Michigan suggests that young children are seeing up to 3 times as much homework as children did 20 years ago. If you feel that your homework load is way too heavy, speak to your parents about that and ask them to talk with the school.
You think that's going to do any good? Even if they did talk with the school, nothing would happen.
You don't know that. That's what you think, but you don't know that. The most debilitating thing you can do in life is to not try something because you think you already know how everything is going to turn out. This stops the energy from flowing even before it has a chance to start. Don't stop yourself before you start. Remember that always. Don't stop yourself before you start. When you stop yourself before you start, you are sure to get nowhere. Then you can make yourself right. You knew all along that you were not going to get anywhere, and you didn't. You're not very happy, but at least you can say you're right. This attitude is what allows people who are not very happy to stay unhappy. It is what allows people who are angry to stay angry. It is what allows people who are not getting anywhere to keep not getting anywhere. Think positively. Throw negative thinking away. Positive thinking actually has a physical effect on life. It sends up vibes. It moves energy around in a particular way. It creates positive outcomes.
I don't know whether to hang with the popular preppy kids or the cast-off grungy kids. Why does everyone have to separate like that?
Separating is a way of seeking identity. For young people, this feels particularly urgent. All of life is a process of defining yourself, of deciding who you are, and it is no different in school. But remember what I said earlier when the discussion was about pressure in school.
Don't do anything that does not feel like you just to be a member of a group. Why not choose not to be exclusive with one group or the other? Be yourself. If it feels as though you'd like to spend time with one group, do it. If it feels as though you'd like to spend time with the other, do it. Don't let either group co-opt you. Groups separate. Individuals unite. It is the job of groups to separate. That's what makes them groups. That's my practical answer. Would you like to hear my spiritual answer?
Sure.
It is not necessary to separate from one another in order to find one's identity. But it sometimes seems that way to people who are living deeply within the illusion of disunity. This illusion holds that unity is not the nature of things, but rather disunity. According to this theory, everything is separate, with individual identities, purposes, and functions. So people believe that separation is necessary for them to be able to fully know themselves. In fact, exactly the opposite is true.
What do you mean?
I mean that it is in unity, not disunity, that your true identity will be found. It is in oneness, not in separation, that your real self will be experienced.
Everything is not separate? Things do not have individual identities, purposes, and functions?
If I told you that your purpose and function is the same as the tree outside your window, that it is the same as the mountain covered with snow, or the ocean lapping at the shore, would you believe me?
Probably not.
Yet it is.
You'd have to explain that to me.
The purpose and function of the tree is growth, and that is your purpose and function as well. It is the purpose and function of all life. You are growing into the grandest version of the greatest vision you ever held about who you are. So is the tree. The only difference is you know it, and the tree does not. You know it at a conscious level, whereas the tree's level of consciousness is not the same as yours. You are aware of yourself. That is, you are self-conscious. Compared to the tree, you are a more highly evolved being, but you are both up to the same thing.
I got it with the tree. I don't get it with the mountain or the ocean.
You don't get that the mountain and the ocean are growing?
No. If anything, they're getting smaller.
Oh, I see. You equate growth with getting bigger.
And you don't?
Growth is evolution in any form. The mountain is changing all the time. So is the ocean. So is all of life. All change is growth. This is what evolution is about. Bigger does not necessarily mean better. Things can grow smaller and be said to have greatly evolved.
I never thought of it that way.
Well, that's the beauty of all really stimulating conversation. It invites you to think of things in new ways.
I have the worst biology teacher in the history of the world. I am falling asleep in there. What am I gonna do? And don't say change classes, because I've already tried that and there aren't any other options.
Talk with the teacher. Tell the teacher that you just aren't getting it, and ask what you can do, maybe even outside of class, to help yourself. Without making the teacher wrong, tell the teacher that you are having a hard time keeping your interest up in class, and ask the teacher if there are any special projects or methods or experiments that you could use to stay more into what's being done. Talk to some other students and see if anyone is having an easier time of it than you. If you find a few, you probably will, ask the teacher if you could team with some of those students now and then on a project or assignment. First, ask the students if that would be all right. This might not only be a way to enliven your experience of the class, it might also be a way for you to get to know some of the other kids a lot better. Talk to your parents about it and see if they have any suggestions. Go to your school counselor as well. Whatever you do, don't just complain about it or do nothing about it, and let that be the reason that you do not do well in class.
Some of the kids are cheating in class and on tests. They want me to join them. I actually could use a little assistance on my geometry tests, and I suppose I could offer some to a few of my friends who aren't doing well in the classes that I like, social studies and French, for instance. But I know cheating is wrong. So,
there is no such thing as right and wrong, as we discussed earlier. There is only what works and what doesn't work, given what you are trying to do.
Great. What I'm trying to do is pass geometry.
Is that all?
What do you mean, is that all?
Is there nothing more you are trying to do?
I don't think so.
Ah, I think there is, although you may not be conscious of it.
So what is it you think that I am trying to do?
You are deciding who you are. You are defining yourself in every single moment. That is what every human being is doing.
You keep saying that.
The thing is, once you understand what you are really doing on this planet, rather than what it looks like you are doing when you buy into the illusion, everything changes. The question changes. The question is no longer, should I cheat on my exam, or can I get away with cheating? The question becomes, is a cheater who I really am? Am I a person who cannot be trusted? Is this who I want to be?
Half the world cheats. My dad probably cheats on his income tax.
And you can be like half of the world. A world, by the way, that you have more than once criticized for not being what you wanted to be, or you can be the change you would like to see in the world.